Hi everyone, I'm Justin Chisholm and you're listening to the Yacht Racing Podcast. My guest on this episode is the legendary Dutch ocean racing skipper Bauer Bekking. Bauer is best known for his around-the-world race campaigns and has no less than 8 Whitbread and Volvo Ocean races to his name. Perhaps even more impressive is the fact that he has finished on the podium in 6 out of 8 of those campaigns. His round-the-world racing career began in 1985 when, at the age of 22, he competed in his first Whitbread race aboard Philips Innovator, and he finished second. Then, 32 years later, in the last edition of the Volvo Ocean Race, he finished third aboard Team Brunel, having been very much in the hunt to take overall victory on that final leg. Away from round-the-world racing, Bauer is a big name on the international regatta circuit, skippering the J-class Lionheart, as well as several other top flight, big boat and super yacht programmes. However, as we'll hear on the podcast, this Dutchman may not yet be finished with round the world racing, and he has hopes of mounting a Swedish flagged entry in the 2021-22 edition of the Ocean Race to help promote the work of the World Childhood Foundation. I spoke to Bauer on Zoom at his home in Denmark, where he's been riding out the COVID-19 pandemic with his family. So, Bauer Bekking, welcome to the Yacht Racing Podcast. It's great to get the chance to catch up with you. Thanks for taking the time. First of all, tell us where in this pandemic world that we're living in you're talking to us from today.
Well, like probably everybody in the world, I'm back home in Denmark. Even though I'm Dutch, I've been living here for 25 years, so I'm in the little town Gilleleje, north of Copenhagen.
And how is the Danish government dealing with the pandemic? I know it's different in each country. Has it been as strict there, or maybe a little more relaxed?
No, I think they actually done a pretty nice job. They closed the borders quite early. I think it was the 11th of March. I was at that stage still in the Caribbean racing. So I think, like, in general, they've been very proactive. And it just shows, even that, of course, we have a small population. I think it's just over 5.5 million people living in Denmark. And the rate of death is, even though it's probably still too much, it's close to 450. So it's not too bad in that sense. And you can just see, they're opening up now a little bit more. Kids going back to school, more and more businesses are opening. But of course, I think in a country when you don't have that much population, it's all going a little bit easier than in countries like the States or even like in England.
That must have been a little bit of a culture shock coming from the Caribbean, where I can remember that regatta still going on. I guess you would. J-class sailing, were you out there and then coming back to?
Yeah, I did the Antigua Superyacht event. I actually didn't sail on the J because I had already a commitment, so I was sailing on the Lya, 112-foot Baltic. And of course, it was very surrealistic because we just knew everything was closing down in Europe, and you race every day, you're having just gatherings with each other, you go out for a meal, and then we just finally got the message that the Simba's bucket was cancelled. Then, of course, it was a matter of getting home. And that was actually the first time that I realized, oh, now it's not going to get that easy, because either the flights were completely full, and as well because Denmark had closed by that stage the borders. It was actually most of the flights into Copenhagen were actually cancelled. But I got to London, and I got on a flight, but even like that, because I don't have a Danish passport. And of course, I didn't have my so-called green card with me from Denmark, so it was actually quite hard to get on the plane, because a lot of Swedish people actually were bounced off the plane. But luckily, I talked my way through and got back home. And then you're coming back home, and then of course you're just coming in the airport, and it was just empty. And then you just say, "Holy smoke, something have happened in the time that I wasn't home." And then you realize, and of course you speak with the home front, speaking with your wife. But you just cannot imagine until you actually face it. So that was a bit of a culture shock.
And what have the limitations been on you since you got back there? Have you been kind of confined to home, or have you been able to get out and do some exercise?
Well, the first the first 14 days, because it was, even that it was not compulsory, because I came from abroad, and even from an island at that stage there was only one person basically observed who had the COVID-19 virus. So, but of course I've flown for England, and England was of course then a little bit more. So the first 14 days I just basically stayed back home. I've got a big garden, and I've got dogs. So I walk my dogs, because I'm living in a very open space, but just basically didn't meet any other people than my wife and my daughter. And now, yeah, after these 14 days, it was just back way more to normal, because you can go out to the shops. All the shops have basically been open for groceries, and even like places where you can buy building materials. So it was quite open over here, but of course, you try to stay away.
Well, I'm speaking to you from Palma. I know it's a place you know well with your sailing projects. And I look out the window here, the bay is completely empty. It's blowing about 30 knots right now, so there probably wouldn't have been too much out today. But it's been very strange here to see, you know, what's a sailing capital just shut down completely. But what's your thoughts on how this might play out for the regatta circuit kind of going forwards over the next 6 to 8, 12 months?
Yeah, I think in a way, of course, we are quite fortunate with the sport what we are having, because it, of course, I think especially like if you talk about the dinghies, I think for dinghies, there shouldn't be any restrictions, in my personal opinion. Say who's sailing one or two persons on a boat, that should be nearly full steam ahead. Of course, it's always the issues when you're having like a skipper's briefing, the gatherings together when they're taking the boats in and out of the water. But I think that should be quite easy to organize. A little bit more of an issue, of course, is having a race committee, because then there's normally like 10 or 15 people packed on a relatively small boat. But I think even that you should be able to manage. If you're speaking about the ocean, more ocean-going yachts, of course, they are very often we sail with 10, 15, 20, 25 people. Then it's, of course, getting a bit harder. And I think in that sense, it's really hard to see how countries, because you're mainly speaking about countries, how they're going to adopt on actually getting events off the ground. Because I cannot see that you're sailing and you're sitting on the rail tightly packed, even that maybe everybody has a clean sheet of health. That you're still with a lot of people together, and if that's smart, maybe not. But of course, time will learn. I don't see any big events happening until August, and that's my personal opinion. But of course, the earlier we can go out sailing, the better it will be.
Well, that's right. I think that's how we all feel. Now, Bauer, you have an amazing career, a very long and illustrious career in yacht racing. You're one of the best known ocean racing skippers that we have. I wondered though, can you just take us back to where it all began? Because we know what you've been doing for the last 35 years with your ocean racing project, but where did it all start? Where did this love of sailing begin? Can you remember?
Well, the love for ocean sailing actually came when in the old days when Connie van Rietschoten did his first round the world race with Flyers sailing for the Netherlands. And at the end of the race, there was a fantastic documentary. And when I saw the first time the documentary, I said, this is something what I'd really like to do. Then he did a second one. He won the second one as well. So saw another documentary. And then by that stage, I was 16, 17 years old. And then I just said to myself, okay, the next time I like to do that race. And then luckily I was quite up in the scene already in the Netherlands, in just sailing on the North Sea. I had the right connections with the right people. And then I did one long race from Rotterdam to the Azores and back. So that was for me like a really long race. And we did that on a small 41 footer built by Royal Huisman aluminum boat. We won that race. And then I bounced into a guy called Dirk Nauta. He had done the round the world race twice before. And he said, I heard that you can sail, so I'd like you to be part of my team. We give it a go. And that's basically, we had a fantastic year actually beforehand, because we had nearly a year of practicing. Of course, if you look back, we did all the things nearly wrong. But I think at that stage, we just, we were very, very young. I think the average age on board was probably 23, 24 years old. The skipper was the oldest one. He was just in his 40s. But for the rest, was all 20, 21 years old. And we raced around the world. We got a second place. Fantastic, fantastic event. And I think I was lucky because Rolf Rolick from Judolf Rolick Design, he had designed the boat where I was sailing on, Philips Innovator. And of course, Rolf was at that stage already quite popular in several countries, and especially in Germany where he had moved to. And then after the race finished, Rolf said, do you want to come maybe working for a very famous owner in Germany? You're going to build a new boat. And even though I was very young, I took that opportunity. And that was Hans-Otto Schumann from the Rubin fame. So I did three boats with him. And I moved over a year to Container from Udo Schütz. Then I ran Albert Bull's boat from Saudade. And then it just kept moving. And actually with Container already, it was one of the first times I started really driving a boat in the Admiral's Cup. Because in all the ones before, I was mainly trimming the mainsail, and just how it goes. Because I was responsible for the boat, I was running the boat. I did a lot of hours doing the delivery, sometimes even just by myself, because that was in the old days. You didn't have a big shore crew; it was just me. So I steered the boats actually quite a bit. And then if you sail a long race and everybody gets tired in the early, just give bow the helm, let him have a go. And then actually people started realizing, gosh, he's quite handy. Yeah, he's actually faster than we are. And that's how it just progressed. So it started with steering. And then with Albert Bull, I actually got the opportunity to start doing the tactics. And I think it was 1990 or 1991. And from one thing comes the other thing. So that's a little bit like the early years. So I think Saudade was the big change in that sense that I got a tactician role.
It sounds from that description that you maybe didn't do that much dinghy sailing in your early life.
I did heaps of dinghy sailing.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I did. I started as a young kid. I sailed in local classes, and then I moved from the local classes to the 420, from the 420 to the laser. But it was one of these things. My parents they loved boating themselves. And they just said, if you want to get to an event, you have to make your own way because we're going to go with our own boat. So I was actually sailing a lot in my local club, which was on a small pond next to a river. Of course, the river had the big advantage that there was current. So you're getting familiar with that kind of things. But the real racing, I couldn't do that much because I was just basically restricted to my area and by my parents to boat have. I did a little bit of star sailing. We were very competitive, and actually we did the trials for Savannah, and we did fantastic well. But then had a fallout with the National Sailing Association about what program we should follow, and from then on it was just for me, because I started already making my money with offshore sailing, and I just said, well, I have to do that event because that's where I make my money with. So that was the dinky part of it, because after that it was just full on in offshore sailing.
Can you remember?
Of course, dinkies is fantastic, because I think it's just one of these things that if you have a feel for, and I think that's still that approach what I'm having, because if you can handle a small boat, you can do the same thing on big boats. And I think that approach I always had, and I always will keep going. How big the boat is, just treat it like a dinky, because you have to have respect for, but you don't have to have respect. Of course, you still have to have respect for horses, but you can get things in place to actually make the handling in such a way that you can sail it like a dinghy.
Can you remember the time when you decided you were going to make your career as a professional sailor? Was there one particular moment, or did it just evolve and develop slowly?
Well, I think I had a plan in my mind, because I did nautical school, because it was one of the things when I did my first round the world race, or before the first round the world, I said, okay, what are my best chances actually to get on board, and then I said, okay, what are the opportunities, because I just finished like high school. And so I went to nautical school. I got a Navy, Merchant Navy degree, but actually never went to sea, because I got actually my sailing time on my first round the world race. maybe the really classic way, getting it on a sailboat, but I actually never used my Merchant Navy papers. But it was just, and I think after I did the first round of the world race, we didn't get paid. We got a color television and a VCR player at the end of the race. But I just knew this is something what I like to do. And I knew already by that stage that I probably was pretty handy. I got the opportunity in Germany. And from then I actually thought this is something where I can make my living with, and I really enjoy it.
I like the idea that you got a color television and a VCR, and of course that would have been because it was Philips was the sponsor back then.
Yeah, Philips was the sponsor, but it was just it. That was how the whole project was. The skipper got paid, and the rest of the guys, and I think we were at 10, we all sailed there just for the love of the sport.
And I wonder, just thinking about the sponsor aspect to it, did you have any kind of, I wonder how sponsors were viewed back then by the sailors, by the teams, because you're there, as you say, for the love of it. The sponsor is not paying you directly, but it's funding the whole adventure that you're on. Did you feel a loyalty to the sponsor?
Yeah, I think that was from day one. You really like, I think by Yardies in general, we always realize that why can we race? It's either a sponsor or a wealthy owner or some other partner or sponsor what you're having. And I think that was already in my first race. Of course, you have sometimes hard things, and you all really like, you have to go to the embassies and really the formal things, having jacket and tie on. And that was, of course, was maybe a little bit of the downside, but you had that same proud feeling what you have, like even like in the last races when you are pulling the lead and you know you are the ambassadors for the brand. But already in the early days, I think I always had that feeling, I'm representing a company who's actually making it possible that I'm sailing over here.
Yeah, I think that's something that's going to be even more important now going forwards in this new world that they're living in, that we're all living in, is just how we position yacht racing and these big projects like the Ocean Race and the America's Cup to commercial partners. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, but I think like if you talk about the Volvo Ocean Race or not on the Ocean Race, if you just speak to all the partners who have been involved in and if you just hear the stories or you read the reports, it is just, I think it's the best sport that I ever have been into, because even that sailing still has a rich man's etiquette on them. Unfortunately, people and companies who have been involved in other sports, they just see how much more they're getting back by entering in the Ocean Race with the team, because the context, first of all, with the athletes, it's fantastic. You've seen yourself, we're doing the Pro-Am races. Who can stand with the best players in the world on the pitch? That's I think it's nearly an experience what is paying the whole campaign for a lot of the companies who are involved in. And then of course as well, if we are on the dock, it's not like they have to sign in for a 10-minute chat with Bao Becking or with Peter Berling. If they rock up, we make time for them. And I think that is just, I think that's really a fantastic part, sailors in general, that they understand, because we love the sport so much, but it's just that understanding of we are there because they make it actually possible. And they visit their clients and always enthusiastic. And people are always smiling when they're coming off board. Maybe have once or twice that somebody is not so happy because he or she gets seasick. But even when they're on the shore, they said, this was the best what I ever experienced. And I think for 98% of all the people having the chance to sail on board, they just said, this is the most fantastic experience I've ever seen, I've ever had in my life.
I absolutely agree with you. And that's what I'm told by sponsors and sponsors' guests that I've been involved in over a few races. I think the important thing is that that anybody can take you to the cricket or the rugby or the football or to Formula One, but only a Volvo Ocean Race team can take you to the Volvo Ocean Race. And there is a mystique and a glamour to the fact that this is a round the world race. This is not, you guys didn't arrive by plane in first class, you know, to do your sport. You raced here across oceans. That makes it special, doesn't it?
Well, I think that makes it, which other event there is in the world? There isn't anything. So sailing 9 months around the world, coming to all the continents, then having 9 or 10 stopovers in different countries so they can activate in these places as well. And I think as well, it was always really hard to get the message over how tough it actually was and what kind of conditions we were sailing. And I think the last race just shown the entire world, holy smoke, this is something crazy. This is really top athletes pushing themselves not only for one day, 2 days a week. Now there are 20, 25 days going full noise in really harsh conditions. If you just could manage some way somehow to get the temperature down as well and the humidity, then it would be fantastic. But I think just last race it just showed. And I remember when we, because that's one of the things as well, and that's why I think I love the sport, because we were sailing in the Southern Ocean on the lake from New Zealand to Cape Horn. And it was just one of these days, was 30, 35, 40 knots. And you just, sometimes you have to tap the guys on the shoulder and just say, just realize what, just how fantastic it is, how miserable it is, but look how fantastic sailing we are. And that was with Jan Ryu. I said, Jan, you have to get the drone in the air right now, because this is epic. If we can get this footage out, first of all, you will be famous, but I think as well, our sponsors and our families back home as well, they can really see what we go through. And I think Jan actually set bar over there and got the message out. And I think that was, I think it is just something that everybody just saw. This is top sport.
I know exactly the footage you're talking about. And I remember gasping when I saw the footage come back to land, and it was published up on the Volvo website at that point. And you're right, for so long we've seen the photographs from on board the boat, and we've tried to imagine what it's like for you guys to be racing down there. And now finally we could see it. But here's my question: when you watched that footage back, maybe after the leg or after the race, did you get a different viewpoint of the Southern Ocean and what you were doing down there?
I every time I see the footage, I just go, yes, fantastic. It's just, I just love it. And of course, you have a responsibility. And I'm very honest. I'm not always the guy who's smiling 100%, because you're still having the responsibility, of course, for your team, but more important for the families back home. And of course, for your sponsors. So there are really moments that you say, holy smoke. We should throttle down, why are we actually pushing it this hard? And of course, then you just have to trust yourself in making the right decisions. So, but when you see the footage back, yeah, I always get a smile on my face, because it is just a fantastic feeling. And I think actually one of the best shots we ever had in the last race was the last night before we came into Newport, Rhode Island. We have been leading, I think, most of the leg for 7 or 8 days, had a lead. And then we sailed through the Gulf Stream. We just had to cross the Gulf Stream. And there's some night footage. And that is just unbelievable. And I think that's the most fascinating night footage I've seen, because then people can really see. It's not only during the day, fantastic shots from the outside, but just the footage what we had I think it was 40, 45 knots. And I think we had Peter Burling on the helm. And we had to put a reef in the mainsail. And you could just see just the communication. And that was, yeah, I think it's one of the most epic moments, I think, what you can see back.
Talk a little bit about these onboard reporters that have come to the forefront over the last few editions of the race. They've made a huge difference. I can't remember when they were first introduced, whether they were welcomed with open arms by the sailors or not, but now it seems like they're a real key part of the whole setup when you're picking a crew for the event.
Yeah, of course, it has been involved, and in the beginning it was pure sailors who had to take a camera in their hand and were filming, and And actually, I think they even could help with a lot of things on board. But yeah, then of course it evolved over the time, and the organization got more handle of it. They wanted to have better footage. They wanted to have really people, especially when we started with sailing with the one design, because I think then they put the rules in place. The persons who are getting on board as board reporters, they have to have a background. They have to, they don't really have a sailing background, but they have to have a background on either being fantastic journalists, fantastic program makers. And that set a little bit everything up. In the first race where we did with the Volvo 65s, we could, you could pick our own onboard reporter. And of course, I think that was the right thing. And that's the, one of the reasons why they changed actually the rules for the next edition. Because in the last edition, the organization actually put the reporters in place and we just had to take them. But already from the first one, we could see, we picked an onboard reporter who was important for us as a team. He was part of the team. He was specifically picked because he did things very well in the Netherlands, which was our main place for getting basically the publicity. And in the last race, we got four or five different reporters on board. And unfortunately, in our case, there wasn't a Dutch guy. Nothing against the guys, because we had some fantastic times with it. But sometimes you have to be able to feed your own market. And in our case, of course, the Netherlands was most important, having a Dutch sponsor, having Scheveningen as a stopover. So it was pretty hard in the last race. And as well that you had to change, because it's still, there is so much trust involved. And you and I, now we're talking, I think, quite freely, because you know the background as well. But if you imagine now yourself, you stepping on board, you being the reporter, and all of a sudden you have to sail with a team who you maybe know from face, but you don't know how they're reacting. You don't know which button you can push on and which ones you shouldn't push on, because then the shit hits the fan, let's say it that way. So that was really hard. And of course, I think we have been very fortunate. We had a couple of really good guys, and but some just didn't click. And that's a shame, because I think the onboard reporters can't do their work so well. And I think that happened already in the last race. The more we got to the end, we started sailing longer with the same onboard reporter. And that just, you know, you just get a better product. So in that sense, I think for the next race, when they said, you, each team, pick their own person. Of course, they have to go through like a run sheet, what they all can be able to do. They have to work with the equipment. So I think the setup is way better for the next edition.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it's a tough job to walk onto an ocean racing crew, perhaps that you don't know, and try and gel with them enough to get your job done, but also not try and become their friends, because sometimes you're going to be filming them doing something maybe they don't want you to do. I think it's a tremendously difficult job, and I think picking their OBRs is absolutely the way to go. And it's I think I talk to a lot of people who want to be OBRs, and it can sound very glamorous to race around the world and take these amazing shots, but it's also a pretty brutal life on board for them as well, right? Because they can't contribute to the day-to-day running of the boat, so they are just slightly separate to the crew.
I think it's in a way the just psychologically, it's probably the hardest job, because even that they're, and I think especially if they're more part of the team, but in the last race, some of the guys really felt lonely sometimes, and of course that doesn't make work easier. See, now imagine now people now with the coronavirus, there's some people have been sitting by themselves. Imagine you're sitting 40 days, or the last race was 20, 25 days on board, and you don't have any real friends, people who you maybe really appreciate, but there is no contact. And of course, that's tough. And then you expect things still from them. They still have to help with the cooking. They have to help with bailing the water out. But then if the person gets seasick, what happened with some of the OBRs, then of course it's tough on them. It's easy for us. We can go on deck and go sailing for 4 hours. They just have to keep thinking in that confined space where they are. How can I get new footage out? How can I be really creative? and it's every day the same. Sometimes, you know, when we're sailing in the trades, you have 6-7 days, just the same as the last day. And it just goes on and on and on. And then you have to be creative. So they're draining themselves, I think, in their minds so much. I think it's actually, yeah, sometimes harder to be an onboard reporter than actually a sailor.
I think so. Now, Bal, I wanted to just to dig in a little bit about the ocean race itself and your track record with it. It is quite remarkable. I hope I've got this right. 8 races, finished on the podium 6 times. In those 6 podiums, you were second on 4 occasions, and 2 of those were second places in the last 2 editions. That's a extremely...
Well, last edition we were third.
You were third, okay. I knew I must have got something wrong in all those numbers. Yeah. Okay, but still on the podium. It just a remarkable track record in this. The kind of elephant in the room is that this is a race that you haven't won, even though you've been trying for all these times. When you look back on this track record right now, do you look back on it with pride and satisfaction, or is there that underlying frustration that you still haven't lifted the trophy yet?
Well, I think just in general, you're entering a race because I like to win it. And it doesn't matter whether it's the race or it's just the Wednesday night regatta or you're sailing a world championship. I think that is just races have that in them. And I know I won a lot of events, and up till now I haven't won the ocean race. So it is frustrating, but still, when I look back, I think I had so much satisfaction, and I think fantastic results because it is hard. And if you get beaten by a team who's just better, because you know what they have been going through, they had the same hurdles to overcome as myself and my team. So it is just. Sometimes it's the luck of the draw. I think that was the last race, especially with 1 leg to go, 3 boats on equal points. Who's going to win? That's sometimes how sailing goes, because it's not always. It is not prediction. You cannot say I'm having a faster boat or having a better crew, because I think the crews were all equal. And Dongfeng made the best call on the last race. And basically on the last leg. And that's how yacht racing goes as well. Then I think I remember I came into Scheveningen. It was hometown, or of course you hope you're winning in your hometown. But it's just, I can't change it. And that is one of the things I think that you, when you're growing up, you realize that sometimes life goes, how frustrating it can be. It's just that you can't anymore, because that's what the result is, and how much you would dream about it. I like to dream about winning it, but it is a tough cookie to crack.
When you finish a race like that, typically, how long does it take you to kind of re-enter society, as it were? Because you've been living and breathing this race, all-consuming for probably 2 years by that stage. Does it take you a while to re-enter society as a normal individual?
No, I don't think so. And I think especially because that is just one of the things, and that's really one of the hardest things. I always tell my crew, like, if you're halfway, you have to start planning for the future, guys, because if this is going to end, and it's going to end, the contract will be finished. All of a sudden, you're standing in an empty space. And that's, I think, one of the advantages that I've done the race so many times. I just know what to expect afterwards. So for me, it's straight away coming back into the scene, because basically I've given jobs away from other projects where I'm normally involved with. I've got people just standing in for me. And of course, some of them do a fantastic job. So you never know if an owner of a partner or a sponsor will take you back, because it's a free world over here. But I normally try to get in racing very quickly. Sometimes it was a week after the finish that I was that I've been back on a boat again, and that's of course because you have to think again about your livelihood, and you have to keep sailing. I think that's one of the also really important things. If you're not getting on the water, you will be getting toast very quickly. If you don't get results, people forget. I think that's one of the things, and it's again because I like the sailing. That is just one of the things. I love to be on the water. I love to be with a team, so you have to get going again. And of course, I try to spend as much as time with my family when you're back. But it's our lifestyle.
that's something that comes over very strongly with you, is that you just love the sport, you love participating in the sport. I do know professional sailors who do it as a job, as a living, and they treat it in that way, and I don't think they have quite the love that you do for it.
Yeah, but it is, I think, still one of these things. And that's, I think, the fantastic thing about sailing. Look, even in the last race, I think the average age, and just in general, if you see offshore race, it's nearly scary to see how old we all are. I think if you sit in any other sport, biobanking is going to enter, which is now 56 years old. They start laughing. But it is just shown in our sport, the experience is just massive. It is, it's just so different than other sports. And I think as well that the mental part of it, I think that's a thing where people underrate maybe in a big way. And but you have to have the love. If you don't have the love for it, I think you will not survive, because then it's too tough. It will be way easier to take a job on the shore.
That's right. I wanted to pick your brains about the boats that we've seen in this competition over the years. And just to start with, not in any particular order, but the Whitbread 60s, for me personally, are the ones that just fascinate me, because when I look at them, when I look at the designs sitting next to the Volvo 70s and maybe the Maxis from the old days, they just look like, they look like a big 505 dinghy to me, and they don't look like something that you should be racing around the world. Can you kind of describe what, when those boats hit the scene, what was your reaction to them?
You're talking Volvo 60 or Volvo 65s?
No, the Whitbread 60s.
The Whitbread 60s. Well, it was, of course, I think was more or less a mind opener for a lot of people. I think the designs got way more aggressive. Hey, they looked really aggressive with the water ballast. Yeah, there was something nearly unseen of, and the boats were bloody strong. Actually, there was not a lot of issues with the boats, just the way how they were built. I think it was also the first edition that that actually the organization had a certain panel weight for areas in the boat, like for the hull, some parts of the hull in the bottom and the top sides. And then the deck had a different panel weight. So that was the first time actually a class was built, really with a lot of hindsight. How can we make a boat what is strong, safe? Because that should be the ultimate thing when you go ocean racing. It has to be safe. But the parameters they set, I think, was quite good. But we had an aluminum mast still on the first edition. And we know now the editions after, in the end, the last race we had when we sailed with the 60s, we had a carbon rig. That was a huge difference. But it's just, we pushed these boats, of course, very hard, but they were way less wet than, for example, in the last race or in the last, or even with the Volvo 70s, because it's still one of these things that they looked at going fast, and the boat was going fast, but relatively seen, when you go much slower, and they went much slower, there's coming way less water over the deck. So in a way, it was a way drier boat and easier to sail. Easy to sail only in one way, because they were actually quite hard, because we still had the spinnaker poles we had on, and even I think in the first race we even have a proper spinnaker on. And then of course Chris Dixon was one of the first ones who found the loop roll with the code zeros just not the loophole, but he just was very smart with his sailmakers at that stage. I think it was Lidcard even, who had an idea on how to circumvent the spinnaker rule. And so there was a lot of development going on. And I think Laurie Smith was one of the first who developed the really good halyard locks, where you could actually hang a sail up, because I think in the first race, we still had to send somebody up and put a manual lock. So you had to hoist somebody in the pitch dark of the night in 30, 35 knots. You had to hoist them up. And he had to put a strop on it, which he then had to release from the bottom. So there has been so much development going on. And it was a fantastic boat at that stage. But I think they were super safe. And I think it just shows in all the track records as well. I think a couple of boats lost their rig. Some rudders were left behind. But I think all the hulls they did pretty well.
And when you talk to the pro sailors, generally they get misty-eyed about the Volvo 70s that, you know, we'll never see their like again, and that these were the kind of definitive boats of the Volvo. What's your view on that?
Yeah, of course, it was a huge step with the keel, but as well, and I think I was on the bad side of that with Movistar. Maybe hindsight, we sailed way too many miles with the boat, because everybody probably remember the second last leg on the third last leg, we lost the boat. It was just finished. It was just not strong enough. And that's harsh, but the sailing, and especially the generations after, they were fantastic. When we sailed with Movistar, there was Juan K design. He had a way better concept, and that's why he just screamed at. And I think the guys could have sailed with two guys on deck and they would have still won, because they were going a knot, two, three knots faster than our design. But then next generations, yeah, they were just awesome boats, because they just, you could just push them and they kept going faster and faster and faster. And I think that's why a lot of damage actually occurred on them, because we yacht racers, we're very difficult to down throttle. You want to keep pushing. I think in the last edition, what they had, I think the leg from with the brace with the 70s from Auckland to Brazil, I think nearly all the boats had major damage, big D-lam, etc. So it's just one of these things, because the boats were just so fast, and they could go faster and faster, but they were breaking down because it was just not strongly enough built.
Yeah. I remember that leg. I was working for the organization, and I remember that leg particularly. We had boats sinking, we had boats on ships, we had boats with rigs down. I think Kenny Reed was the only one that didn't have major damage. And when I asked him in Brazil, how did they get through it? He looked me in the eye and said, pure luck, completely pure luck.
Don't ask me.
Yeah. He told me stories about launching off waves and landing with such a crash that they were convinced the boat was going to fall apart or the rig was going to come down, and then just being so relieved that none of those things had happened. So now, when you look back across all of your round the world races, I guess the problem with Movistar might stand out as one that you'll never forget, but
shit happens.
Yeah, exactly. But kind of other than that, which ones stand out, or are there kind of moments from all of those races that you just kind of look back on from time to time and kind of
remember? There's a lot of, if you look back and you reflect on everything, of course, the first one is always, I think it's one of the best things. So the first race, because you fulfill a dream, and I made my living, I decided I'm going to make my living out of that. So that is special. And I think we had, but if you look back with the young people and the experience what we had, we had a fantastic result. And I think the one with Dennis Connor was really special for me, because it was actually the year that I married with my wife. How crazy it sounds, but we joined the race. So that's a really special moment. There's nothing sailing, but it's just one of these things that is sticking out. And then I think the last race with Team we were so late at the table. We got the sponsorship through in the end of July. In a way, we were lucky as well, because there was some really good sailors after the America's Cup who were available. I think if we would have had been earlier, we wouldn't have had the guys like Peter Burling and Carl Langford, because they were occupied. But of course, we were on the back foot. But then if you see how we got better and better and better during the race, that is something I think an incredible feeling that you can see from coming from nowhere, but everybody just keeping that same belief and that same focus. And of course, it's a lot of talking, a lot of work, but that is just a feeling as well, that it gives so much satisfaction that you, even as a late starter, still nearly would have grabbed the trophy.
I think your comeback in that race was one of the most exciting aspects for the fans of the race, certainly was from my side of things, because as you say, you did start off with some poor results and then you went on a charge.
You were just not good enough, and I think that's one of the, and that's really hard. See a guy like Peter Burling, And what has he not won? And then all of a sudden, you're getting your butt kicked. And it's the same for myself. The summer before, we won the races with the J class. You know, you can do a fantastic job. And then all of a sudden, you're getting beaten. And a guy like Andrew Capey. And I think that's the good thing when you're having the older guys, because you just know you have to keep pushing, you have to keep going. And even for the guys who have the best sailors in the world, they're all of a sudden, holy smoke, we have to act, we have to get better. We have to do things that we can pick up, because otherwise we're going to lose this race. And I think that whole mentality, what we got on the team, and we had some crew changes because there was basically no time before. So in the end, I think we got a fantastic mix of people, and all with that same goal, and having responsibilities, taking the responsibilities as well. And that's one, I think, one of the things what makes sailing so interesting, because it's not a one-man show. You have to do with a team, and every piece in the puzzle has to fit. And I think in the end, we got it right. And we didn't win, but I think it was a great effort.
Yeah, I mean, you went on an incredible charge over the latter stages of the race, where you couldn't get off the podium and you were winning legs, and it was just like a transformed team. But was there one particular moment, or was there one particular thing that you did that kind of just made the change? Or,
well, maybe you remember. So I think we were a team already in the race before who had like what we call a mental coach. And I think it's one of these things what we've learned, or what I learned over the races before. You might have all the coaches in the world you might have, but in the end, it has to be right in between the ears. The communication has to be good. And it's one of the things when you are a skipper of a team, it's even like if you are a director in the company, people are still hesitant to go to the boss. Somehow, there's always some sort of a distance. The first race, what we did with Team Brunel, because we have one of the sponsors who's in coaching, so we got one of their coaches, but she came back with us. And of course, you evaluating every leg. And I think even the leg to Auckland, because that's what basically the change happened. We sailed a very good leg, and then we were a little unlucky. We were actually unlucky. It's just one of these things what can happen. And that just set a tone, because then all of a sudden, of course, the sponsors are not happy anymore. How is it possible you guys have the best team on paper and there's no results? And then that's three different points what we actually worked out. And that was just basically what it came down to. Everything what we do has to contribute to speed. And it's from the smallest details, of course, to the big package. And when that was sitting, these three points were in between the ears of everybody, then the results started coming. And I think as well was one of the things with Andrew Cape, because my butt was on the line, you can say it that way, because they're not happy you taking responsibilities, but as well Andrew Cape, the navigator. So it was the two of us were under pressure, and a lot of people probably would have cracked. We backed each other and say, we're having the squad here together, and he's having my full backup when it comes to going for navigational ideas. And I know KP is just a mastermind. So you have to keep trusting your people, and you have to give them that freedom. You shouldn't get interact. And that was the same with all the others on board. So everybody had their responsibilities. And then, of course, we have been sailing way more together. So you're getting used to each other. You know you're getting better and doing maneuvers. But Auckland was really a point for us, because we had dark faces over there, very, very honestly. But with the mental coach what we had and all the talks, we just started seeing the light on the horizon. And from then on, we were off, more or less. You can call it that way.
Yeah, sometimes in these sporting stories, it needs to be that low point needs to be hit before you can start to rebuild the team. And please do name check the mental coach as you describe her. I think it's a lady.
It's Anja Marijke from Boxtel, and I love her. I can tell you that. I love to work with her. She's a great personality, and that's just one of these things. And I think because we didn't have a sailing coach, and if we would have had a sailing coach, maybe we would have been faster in the beginning. But it's always, you have to have that balance, because there's a budget, and you know you have to run with the budget what you have. And that was even in the last campaign because we were so late. First of all, you have to say, I would really want to start that late with maybe a mid budget. And of course, that's a choice you make. And if it's one of these things with KPO, I say, and that sticks to me, you make a choice to be the right choice. And that's what we did. We chose and we can do it. We think we can do a very good result. And then you have to go through with that. And that's what I said. I just knew we'd need somebody like Anja Marijke, especially because this was the first time that we had to settle with two female on board. So it's just, you know, there will be some interaction changes from female to man than what we had before when you're only sailing with guys on board. So I just knew she was going to be really, really important. And it's proven she was important because I think she was a big part of it, why we got out of our low and started getting better and better.
Yeah, it was certainly a great sporting story and great to watch. Now, you've mentioned him a couple of times. I couldn't possibly have you on the podcast without talking to you about Andrew Cape, who is one of the most amazing characters in ocean racing. He doesn't court publicity very much. He's hard to get on an interview, and I don't think we'll ever get him on the podcast, although I am going to try. But you've sailed a lot with Andrew over the years. He's been a real key partner with you. Can you just talk about what he brings to the campaign and what he brings to your, you know, your kind of personal environment when you're offshore racing?
Yeah, I always say Capey is Capey, guys. Just don't worry too much about him. It's just because he has a very special personality. But I think that's with a lot of navigators. They're very often loners, and not loners in the bad way, because KP is a very sociable guy once he's on the shore and after the job is done. But they are so focused on numbers, on the weather, and KP is just a fantastic sailor as well. So if you're sitting in a debrief and you're just talking about things, all of a sudden KP says something, and then you can just see everyone just writing their back up a little bit, because what he's saying is most of the times it's right. And he makes the point. He's come to the point. He doesn't want to fuzz around. And I think that's one of the things why he doesn't need any publicity or talk to anybody, because it's a waste of time. I want to be functional. I want to be really good at what I'm doing. And he has a special way of living when he's on board. And you have to read him. And I think he's one of these guys, if you give him the trust and you back him up, then, because I say he's hired because he's the best in the world, in my opinion. So it's not up to me. Otherwise, I should hire somebody else. So he's there for making the right decisions. I can back him up or I can give my input, but he is the final responsibility most of the time. So, okay, we're going to do, that's plan A, B, or C. If he says plan A, then I will back him up on that one because he's done his homework, and that's one of these things. He's straight through the sea. I'm not we have a saying in Dutch, but he's just straight as an arrow and yeah, super talented.
Now, this last race finished in The Hague. It was a pretty, you mentioned it a little bit before, it was a pretty special occasion for the crowds there. There were crowds lining the shoreline. That we'd had 2 weeks of Saint-Tropez weather in the Netherlands, and it showed the whole place off at its absolute best, and it was a spectacular occasion for you as a Dutch sailor. That must have been a pretty special moment for you to finish the race in Scheveningen, as you mentioned earlier. I think the reason it was so special was that the Dutch nation's association with this race is huge, isn't it? What is it about the ocean race that really resonates with the Dutch people?
Well, I think first of all, of course, if you look back at the heritage with Connie van Rietschoten in the old days with the Whitbread Round the World race, that was of course something my generation and the older generation all knew who he was. But then in other editions, there was mostly of the time there was a Dutch entry. And we had even a stopover when ABN AMRO won in Rotterdam. And you can just see people love sailing in the Netherlands. And Rotterdam was very successful. Then when we got Team Brunel for the first time, we actually our sponsor self, Team Brunel, said, because we were at that stage also already maybe a little late because the route was already written in sand. And then they said, we want to have a pit stop and otherwise we're not entering. So that was playing hardball, and Scheveningen or De Haag got a pit stop. And I think that stop just showed, because the royalties were there, but there were so many people arrived in the middle of the night. And I think in the 2 days that we were in The Hague, I think there was more footfall in these 2 days than in most stopovers in 14 days. And just the ambience what was there with the boats on the water, and it was just one big festival. And of course, then I think one of the things what the organization saw, if for the next race can have to finish over there, it will be a little big party. And of course, we get a lot of people because there's two Dutch boats. We shouldn't forget Axel Nobel was there at very early stages. You know that campaign very well. And yeah, if you then arrive, and even that we didn't win, it's just it's just one of these things. We in Holland can do some things. You talk about it, but we do it as well. And you just know the people, sport. And I think again, not only myself, but we have a lot of very good buddies in the Netherlands, and a guy like Simeon Timpont. Was his first with the skipper, but he did a fantastic job to the public. And so it was not the people coming for us. They were coming for both Dutch teams and for the other teams, because they've been following the race. They all knew these people who finished this race, they more or less deserve a fantastic welcome. And of course, it's we didn't win, but I said to my crew, the race is only over until the last day, the import race, so we better win the import race in our home waters. And I think that was for us that was a big focus, and I think most of the other people forgot already about it, but we still had a chance to come on the podium for the inshore races. But winning that last race back home will be just a little extra payback for all our partners and sponsors, and of course for the Dutch public. So we had a fantastic finish the last import race, and I think it's one of these things where you can just dream about.
So now I want to just start to wrap things up, because I'm looking at the clock. We've been talking for a long time already. The childhood project that I know you've been working on, I don't know masses about it, but it's a project that was the childhood project was something that was started by Queen Silvia of Sweden. And you seem to be now part of that whole project to help raise the profile of that. Is this going to lead to an entry in the next race, potentially?
Well, it's one of these things. We just said, what can we do for this upcoming race? And we've been going through a lot of talks in all the previous editions. And in general, just everybody, all the companies say, it's fantastic, the Volvo Ocean Race. But still, it's quite difficult, especially if you are listed. You're having your shareholders, you're having even your own employees. And so we're spending so much money on this particular sport. How good the returns are, it's still the perception. The perception has to be right. And that's what I said before, I think, as well. Sailing still has a bad cloud hanging around them. They say it's rich people and blah, blah, blah. But it's not. But it's still, it affects, because in the end, the board or the CEO has to make a call. And I always say, of course, I can understand, because that's a tough one. So if you have a good cause for yourself, or either it's environmental, or in this case with childhood, just protecting children to being safe, not getting abused, that is something but everybody can basically reflect it. So there is way less risk for the company, because that fits in the social responsibility lines, but they normally have all written down in all their programs. So we just said childhood came up, and it came through our Swedish partners, and we signed a contract basically until the end of this year, in September we have a contract with them, because there was one Swedish company, and I can call the name here, Sleto. They said, we will be part of it. We see all the good things about it. We're going to pay the bill to sell under childhood, get all the media coverage for them. And we're going to try to find partners in the meantime. And that's, of course, Now we have to renegotiate, of course, the terms, and of course it's now hard because there is the environmental issue what we're having right now with the coronavirus. So it's just things are on hold right now, and that's what the reality is. So in the meantime, of course, you cannot put all your eggs in one basket. If childhood would continue, we can use their name, would be fantastic. But if not, so that's why we're looking at other opportunities as well, because what I said, it is a fantastic sport. And but we think in general, if you can sell for a good cause, you have maybe a bigger chance of landing several sponsors than that you land one big one, because at smaller amounts, you can still do more or less the same thing when you're in stopovers or during the race itself.
And just to check, this would be a Volvo 65 campaign or a potential?
Yeah, that's what we said from the beginning. Of course, fantastic with the Imokas, but it's just a matter of you're selling a project. And I think it's one of these things, and I think that's one of the things what we learned from the Volvo 70s or from all the other campaigns before that. If you have a fast boat, you have the fastest boat, there's a big chance you win. And everybody thinks they're having the best boat, but if you have a lemon, and that can happen, of course, that it's going to be a long race. So it is. We think it's a bad investment for a sponsor to do that race in a Imoca before they have a better chance, a better platform, way more people. It's better for corporate sailing because there's way more space. We can sail with 20 people on board. I think if in Imoca might be lucky that they get 4 or 5 guests on board because there's just no space. So we put the balance heavily to the Volvo 65, and then as well we said, the budget is probably going to be quite a bit lower as well. So that, of course, is one of the things as well. We have to get the funding together. But we think it's the people who will make the big difference. And, of course, if you have a company who's totally in technology, great if they want to do the Imokas. I think fantastic boats. I love to see them sailing, and I love to have a go on them for transatlantic or something like that. But it is just bullet points next to each other. We came to the conclusion that the Volvo 65 at this time is the best place for us to put it on for the next race.
And with you in the role of skipper, Bao, is that sorry to be blunt?
Well, I plan to do another time as a skipper. That's just one of these things. When I said it before, I'm maybe the old chap in the league, but I'm still, I think, very fit, and I think I can do not only good for. Especially now with how the project is set up, with even more young sailors, I think I can bring a lot of knowledge over to the newer generation, and then as well, of course, I can represent the sponsors really good. And I think that's still, I think I've shown in the past. Unfortunately, I haven't won the race, but I think I always gave the max return for the sponsors, and that's just the thing. And that's especially with the younger kids. We have to teach them still in a way. That's what I say. We sailors are open-minded, but you can still guide them in that sense as well, because we're there because they are there. That's the challenge what you always have to face.
Your level of confidence of putting a team in next time?
Yeah, I think very good actually, but that's always, you can't be negative. And we know as well there will be a lot of talks, and probably still, but you just know 99% will fall off. You still have to get that one last final percent. But I think just with the history, what we're having, especially in the Volvo 65 and the campaigns, maybe we didn't have the biggest budgets, but we've done fantastic as well, not only on the water, but I think as well media-wise results. And I think that's, in the end, it's still it's a big part of it. Of course, winning is the icing on the cake. But I think it is a return on investment for the partners who step in. And I think we have a very good track record. And as such, I see as well that they probably think this is the team where we want to line up with.
Well, it would be fantastic to see you back in the race. I love the idea of the childhood project. It's a great foundation. It's a great cause to be promoting. So the best of luck with that. Bao, thanks a million for talking to us today on the podcast. It's been as interesting as I expected it to be. And hopefully we'll be able to check in at the end of the year and hear some positive news about the Ocean Race campaign. But for now, Bao Becking, thanks a million.
No worries. Have a nice day.
Well, that's it for this episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Bauer Becking, and my thanks go to him for taking the time to speak to me. Thanks also, as ever, to all of you for listening wherever you are in the world. If you're enjoying listening to the Yacht Racing Podcast, then please do take a moment to give it a rating and leave a review. I really appreciate it, as it helps us a lot in our efforts to expand our audience. So until the next episode, I'll just say, stay safe, everyone.